steps are negative. They tell you what not to do. They don't tell you what to do. The five precepts are the basis of Buddhist morality. They are not all of it. We start by recognizing our bad behavior and striving to stop doing it. That is what the five precepts are for. After we have stopped doing bad, we then commence to do good. Take, for example, speech. The Buddha says we should start by refraining from telling lies. After that, we should speak the truth. Speak gently and politely, and speak at the right time. He says, giving up false speech, he becomes a speaker of truth, reliable, trustworthy, dependable. He does not deceive the world. Giving up malicious speech, he does not repeat there what he has heard here, nor does he repeat here what he has heard there, in order to cause variance between people. He reconciles those who are divided and brings closer together those who are already friends. Harmony is his joy. Harmony is his delight. Harmony is his love. It is the motive of his speech. Giving up harsh speech, his speech is blameless, pleasing to the ear, agreeable, going to the heart, urbane, liked by most. Giving up idle chatter, he speaks at the right time, what is correct, to the point, about Dhamma, and about discipline. He speaks words worth being treasured up, seasonable, reasonable, well-defined, and to the point. Number 5. Rebirth. Where does man come from, and where is he going? There are three possible answers to this question. Those who believe in a god, or gods, usually claim that before an individual is created, he does not exist. Then he comes into being through the will of a god. He lives his life and then, according to what he believes or does during his life, he either goes to eternal heaven or eternal hell. There are others, humanists and scientists, who claim that the individual comes into being at conception due to natural causes, lives, and then at death ceases to exist. Buddhism does not accept either of these explanations. The first gives rise to many ethical problems. If a good God really creates each of us, it is difficult to explain why so many people are born with the most dreadful deformities, or why so many children are miscarried just before birth, or are stillborn. Another problem with the theistic explanation is that it seems very unjust that a person should suffer eternal pain in hell for what he did in just 60 or 70 years on earth. 60 or 70 years of non-belief or immoral living does not deserve eternal torture. Likewise, 60 or 70 years of good living seems a very small outlay for eternal bliss in heaven. The second explanation is better than the first and has more scientific evidence to support it, but still leaves several important questions unanswered. How can a phenomenon so amazingly complex as consciousness develop from the simple meeting of two cells, the sperm and the egg? And now that parapsychology is a recognized branch of science, phenomena like telepathy are increasingly difficult to fit into the materialistic model of the mind. Buddhism offers the most satisfactory explanation of where man came from and where he is going. When we die, the mind, with all the tendencies, preferences, abilities, and characteristics that have been developed and conditioned in this life, reestablishes itself in a fertilized egg. Thus, the individual grows, is reborn, and develops a personality conditioned both by the mental characteristics that have been carried over and by the new environment. The personality will change and be modified by conscious effort and conditioning factors like education, parental influence, and society, and once again at death, reestablish itself in a new fertilized egg. This process of dying and being reborn will continue until the conditions that cause it, craving and ignorance, cease. When they do, instead of being reborn, the mind attains a state called nirvana. And this is the ultimate goal of Buddhism and the purpose of life. How does the mind go from one body to another? Think of it being like radio waves. The radio waves, which are not made up of words and music, but energy at different frequencies, are transmitted, travel through space, are attracted to and picked up by the receiver, from where they are broadcast as words and music. It is the same with the mind. At death, mental energy travels through space, is attracted to and picked up by the fertilized egg. As the embryo grows, it centers itself in the brain from where it later broadcasts itself as the new personality. Is one always reborn as a human being? No, there are several realms in which one can be reborn. Some people are reborn in heaven, some are reborn in hell, some are reborn as hungry ghosts, and so on. Heaven is not a place, but a state of existence, where one has a subtle body, and where the mind experiences mainly pleasure. Some religions strive very hard to be reborn in a heavenly existence, mistakenly believing it to be a permanent state. But it is not. Like all conditioned states, heaven is impermanent, and when one's lifespan there is finished, one could well be reborn again as a human. Hell, likewise, is not a place, but a state of existence, where one has a subtle body, and where the mind experiences mainly anxiety and stress. Being a hungry ghost, again, is a state of existence, where the body is subtle, and where the mind is continually plagued by longing and dissatisfaction. So, heavenly beings experience mainly pleasure. Hell beings and ghosts experience mainly pain, and human beings experience usually a mixture of both. So, the main difference between the human realm and the other realms is the body type and the quality of experience. What decides where we will be reborn? the most important factor, but not the only one, influencing where we will be reborn and what sort of life we shall have, is karma. The word karma means action and refers to our intentional mental actions. In other words, what we are is determined very much by how we have thought and acted in the past. Likewise, how we think and act now will influence how we will be in the future. The gentle, loving type of person tends to be reborn in a heaven realm, or as a human being, who has a predominance of pleasant experiences. The anxious, worried, or extremely cruel type of person tends to be reborn in a hell realm, or as a human being who has a predominance of painful experiences. The person who develops obsessive craving, fierce longings, and burning ambitions that can never be satisfied tends to be reborn as a hungry ghost, or as a human being frustrated by longing and wanting. Whatever mental habits are strongly developed in this life will continue in the next life. Most people, however, are reborn as human beings. So we are not determined by our karma. We can change it. Of course we can. That is why one of the steps on the Noble Eightfold Path is perfect effort. It depends on our sincerity, how much energy we exert, and how strong the habit is. But it is true that some people simply go through life under the influence of their past habits, without making an effort to change them, and falling victim to these unpleasant results. Such people will continue to suffer unless they change their negative habits. The longer the negative habits remain, the more difficult they are to change. The Buddhist understands this and takes advantage of each and every opportunity to break mental habits that have unpleasant results, and to develop mental habits that have a pleasant and happy result. Meditation is one of the techniques used to modify the habit patterns of the mind, as does speaking or refraining to speak, acting or refraining to act in certain ways. The whole of the Buddhist life is a training to purify and free the mind. For example, if being patient and kind was a pronounced part of your character in your last life, such tendencies will reemerge in the present life. If they are strengthened and developed in the present life, they will reemerge even stronger and more pronounced in the future life. This is based upon the simple and observable fact that long-established habits tend to be difficult to break. Now, when you are patient and kind, it tends to happen that you are not so easily ruffled by others. You don't hold grudges. People like you, and thus your experiences, tends to be happier. Now, let us take another example. Let us say that you came into life with a tendency to be patient and kind due to your mental habits in the past life. But in the present life, you neglect to strengthen and develop such tendencies. They would gradually weaken and die out, and perhaps be completely absent in the future life. Patience and kindness being weak in this case, there is a possibility that in either this life or in the next life, a short temper, anger, and cruelty could grow and develop, bringing with them all the unpleasant experiences that such attitudes create. We will take one last example. Let us say that due to your mental habits in the last life, you came into the present life with the tendency to be short-tempered and angry. And you realize that such habits only cause you unpleasantness, and so you make an effort to change them. You replace them with positive emotions. If you are able to eliminate them completely, which is possible if you make an effort, you become free from the unpleasantness caused by being short-tempered and angry. If you are only able to weaken such tendencies, they would re-emerge in the next life, where, with a bit more effort, they could be eliminated completely, and you could be free from their unpleasant effects. You have talked a lot about rebirth, but is there any proof that we are reborn when we die? Not only is there scientific evidence to support the Buddhist belief in rebirth, it is the only afterlife theory that has any evidence to support it. There is not a scrap of evidence to prove the existence of heaven, and of course, evidence of annihilation and death must be lacking. But during the last 30 years, parapsychologists have been studying reports that some people have vivid memories of their former lives. For example, in England, a 5-year-old girl said she could remember her other mother and father, and she talked vividly about what sounded like the events in the life of another person. Parapsychologists were called in, and they asked her hundreds of questions to which she gave answers. She spoke of living in a particular village in what appeared to be Spain. She gave the name of the village, the name of the street she lived in, her neighbors' names and details about her everyday life there. She also tearfully spoke of how she had been struck by a car and died of her injuries 2 days later. When these details were checked, they were found to be accurate. There was a village in Spain with the name the 5-year-old girl had given. There was a house of the type she had described in the street she had named. What is more, it was found that a 23-year-old woman living in the house had been killed in a car accident 5 years before. Now, how is it possible for a 5-year-old girl living in England and who had never been to Spain to know all these details? And of course, this is not the only case of this type. Professor Ian Stevenson of the University of Virginia's Department of Psychology has described dozens of cases of this type in his books. He is an accredited scientist whose 25-year study of people who remember former lives is very strong evidence for the Buddhist teaching of rebirth. Some people might say that the so-called ability to remember former lives is the work of devils. You simply cannot dismiss everything that doesn't fit into your belief as being the work of devils. When cold, hard facts are produced to support an idea, you must use rational and logical arguments if you wish to counter them. Not irrational and superstitious talk about devils. You say that talk about devils is superstition, but isn't talk about rebirth a bit superstitious also? The dictionary defines superstition as a belief which is not based on reason or fact, but on an association of ideas, as magic. If you can show me a careful study of the existence of devils written by a scientist, I will concede that belief in devils is not superstition. But I have never heard of any research into devils. Scientists simply wouldn't bother to study such things. So I say there is no evidence for the existence of devils. But as we have just seen, there is evidence which seems to suggest that rebirth does take place. So if belief in rebirth is based on at least some facts, it cannot be a superstition. Well, have there been any scientists who believe in rebirth? Yes, Thomas Huxley, who was responsible for having science introduced into the 19th century British school system, and who was the first scientist to defend Darwin's theories, believed that reincarnation was a very plausible idea. In his famous book, Evolution and Ethics and Other Essays, he says, "In the doctrine of transmigration, whatever its origin, Brahmanical and Buddhist speculation found ready to hand the means of constructing a plausible vindication of the ways of the cosmos to man. Yet, this plea of justification is not less plausible than others, and none but very hasty thinkers will reject it on the ground of inherent absurdity. Like the doctrine of evolution itself, that of transmigration has its roots in the world of reality, and it may claim such support as the great argument from analogy is capable of supplying." Then Professor Gustav Strömberg, the famous Swedish astronomer, physicist, and friend of Einstein, also found the idea of rebirth appealing. "Opinions differ whether human souls can be reincarnated on Earth or not. In 1936, a very interesting case was thoroughly investigated and reported by the government authorities in India. A girl, Shanti Devi from Delhi, could accurately describe her previous life at Mutra, 500 miles from Delhi, which ended about a year before her second birth. She gave the name of her husband and child and described her home and life history. An investigating commission brought her to her former relatives who verified all her statements. Among the people of India, reincarnations are regarded as commonplace. The astonishing thing for them, in this case, was the great number of facts the girl remembered. This and similar cases can be regarded as additional evidence for the theory of the indestructibility of memory." Professor Julian Huxley, the distinguished British scientist who was Director General of UNESCO, believed that rebirth was quite in harmony with scientific thinking. "There is nothing against a permanently surviving spirit individuality being in some way given up at death. As a definite wireless message is given off by a sending apparatus working in a particular way. But it must be remembered that the wireless message only becomes a message again when it comes in contact with a new material structure, the receiver. So, with our possible spirit emanation, it would never think or feel unless again embodied in some way. Our personalities are so based on body that it is really impossible to think of survival, which would be in any true sense personal, without a body of sorts. I can think of something being given off, which would bear the same relation to men and women as a wireless message to the transmitting apparatus. But in that case, the dead would, so far as one can see, be nothing but disturbances of different patterns wandering through the universe until they came back to actuality of consciousness by making contact with something which could work as a receiving apparatus for mind. Practical and down-to-earth people like the American industrialist Henry Ford found the idea of rebirth acceptable. Ford was attracted to the idea of rebirth because, unlike the theistic idea or the materialistic idea, rebirth gives you a second chance to develop yourself. Henry Ford says, "I adopted the theory of reincarnation when I was 26. Religion offered nothing to the point. Even work could not give me complete satisfaction. Work is futile if we cannot utilize the experience we collect in one life in the next. When I discovered reincarnation, it was as if I had found a universal plan. I realized that there was a chance to work out my ideas. Time was no longer limited. I was no longer a slave to the hands of the clock. Genius is experience. Some seem to think that it is a gift or talent, but it is the fruit of long experience in many lives. Some are older souls than others, and so they know more. The discovery of reincarnation put my mind at ease. If you preserve a record of this conversation, write it so that it puts men's minds at ease. I would like to communicate to others the calmness that the long view of life gives to us." So the Buddhist teachings of rebirth does have some scientific evidence to support it. It is logically consistent, and it goes a long way to answering questions that theistic and the materialistic theories fail to do. But it is also very comforting. What can be worse than a theory of life that gives you no second chance? No opportunity to amend the mistakes you have made in this life, and no time to further develop the skills and abilities you have nurtured in this life. But, according to the Buddha, if you fail to attain nirvana in this life, you will have the opportunity to try again next time. If you have made mistakes in this life, you will be able to correct yourself in the next life. You will truly be able to learn from your mistakes. Things you were unable to do or achieve in this life may well become possible in the next life. What a wonderful teaching! Number 6. Meditation. What is meditation? Meditation is a conscious effort to change how the mind works. The Pali word for meditation is bhavana, which means to make grow or to develop. Is meditation important? Yes, it is. No matter how much we may wish to be good, if we cannot change the desires that make us act the way we do, change will be difficult. For example, a person may realize that he is impatient with his wife, and he may promise himself, "From now on, I am not going to be so impatient." But an hour later, he may be shouting at his wife, simply because, not being aware of himself, impatience has arisen without him knowing. Meditation helps to develop the awareness and the energy needed to transform ingrained mental habit patterns. I have heard that meditation can be dangerous. Is this true? To live, we need salt. But if you were to eat a kilogram of salt, it would kill you. To live in the modern world, you need a car. But if you don't follow the traffic rules, or if you drive while you are drunk, a car becomes a dangerous machine. Meditation is like this. It is essential for our mental health and well-being, but if you practice in a stupid way, it could cause problems. Some people have problems like depression, irrational fears, or schizophrenia. They think meditation is an instant cure for their problem. They start meditating, and sometimes their problem gets worse. If you have such a problem, you should seek professional help. And after you are better, then take up meditation. Other people overreach themselves. They take up meditation, and instead of going gradually, step by step, they meditate with too much energy for too long, and soon they are exhausted. But perhaps most problems in meditation are caused by kangaroo meditation. Some people go to one teacher and do his meditation technique for a while. Then they read something in a book and decide to try that technique. Then, a week later, a famous meditation teacher visits town, and so they decide to incorporate some of his ideas into their practice. And before long, they are hopelessly confused. Jumping like a kangaroo from one teacher to another, or from one meditation technique to another, is a mistake. But if you don't have any severe mental problem, and you take up meditation and practice sensibly, it is one of the best things you can do for yourself. How many types of meditation are there? The Buddha taught many different types of meditation, each designed to overcome a particular problem or to develop a particular psychological state. But the two most common and useful types of meditation are mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, and loving-kindness meditation, metta bhavana. If I wanted to practice mindfulness of breathing, how would I do it? You would follow these easy steps. The four P's: place, posture, practice, and problems. First, find a suitable place, perhaps a room that is not too noisy and where you are not likely to be disturbed. Second, sit in a comfortable posture. A good posture is to sit with your legs folded, a pillow under your buttocks, your back straight, the hands nestled in the lap, and the eyes closed. Alternatively, you can sit in a chair as long as you keep your back straight. Next comes the actual practice itself. As you sit quietly with your eyes closed, you focus your attention on the in and out movement of the breath. This can be done by counting the breaths or watching the rise and fall of the abdomen. When this is done, certain problems and difficulties will arise. you might experience irritating itches on the body or discomfort in the knees. If this happens, try to keep the body relaxed without moving and keep focusing on the breath. You will probably have many intruding thoughts coming into your mind and distracting your attention from the breath. The only way you can deal with this problem is to patiently keep returning your attention to the breath. If you keep doing this, eventually thoughts will weaken, your concentration will become stronger, and you will have moments of deep mental calm and inner peace.